Hello everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show on Yoga. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk. On behalf of the Cure Talk, Cure Panel team of Shahrukh Khan and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on yoga. We will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. Cure Panel Talk Show is organized by Cure Talk, the blog of Trialix.com, an online platform to connect patients to clinical trials of new treatments. For information on clinical trials for all conditions, please visit Trialix.com/ask. This is the 9th episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show and the first Cure Panel discussion on yoga. Cure Panel Talk Show broadcasts have received over 32,000 replays till date. Today's yoga panel is co-hosted by co-founder of Trialix and yoga enthusiast Shahrukh Khan. The expert on the show today is Dr. Satbir Khalsa from Harvard Medical School, and he will be addressing the topic, Benefits of Yoga for Managing Stress and Lifestyle Diseases. Dr. Khalsa, I welcome you to the Cure Panel Talk Show. On the panel, we have Dashama, Char Grossman, Krishna Kaur, and Micheline Torsan. On behalf of the Cure Panel Talk Show, I welcome all of you to the show. I will now read out a couple of rules which would make listening to the Cure Panel Talk Show broadcast smoother. If you're listening in to the panel through your phone as well as a computer, please mute or stop the online broadcast on your computer for better audio quality. Callers will be invited to ask questions at the end of the discussion. They can let us know by pressing 1 on their keypads and we will bring them online live. Shahrukh will now introduce us to the expert and the panelists. Shahrukh, you're on.
Welcome everybody to the first Cure Panel on Yoga. We are very excited to host this panel today. As Priya just mentioned, we have been doing these panels mostly inviting leading experts to discuss about myeloma, prostate cancer, with a panel of patients and cancer survivors. But we are very excited about having started a series on yoga, and we want to highlight the science of yoga and what we're learning about this ancient practice in the research labs of leading institutes in the country. And to kickstart the series, we have today Dr. Khalsa from the Harvard Medical School. Dr. Khalsa is the Director of Research for the Kundalini Research Institute and also the Research Director of the Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health. He's also an Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and at Brigham and Women's Hospital. For over 10 years, he has been conducting research on the efficacy of yoga and meditation practices, including evaluation of yoga for insomnia, addiction, back pain, depression, anxiety disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, chronic stress, and mental health in public schools. He's also practiced a yoga lifestyle for over 35 years, is a Kundalini yoga instructor, and directs an elective course at Harvard Medical School in mind-body medicine. We couldn't have had a more profoundly experienced and knowledgeable expert to kickstart this series, and we are very, very heartily welcome Dr. Khalsa on the show today. Dr. Khalsa, you're on air, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show today.
Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction, and it's a pleasure to be on the show. I guess I'm going to start here with about 10 to 15 minutes just to talk a little bit about yoga and yoga research. Right at the outset, whenever you talk about yoga, I think the first thing you have to do is define what you mean by yoga. It has become so popular in the general public that it has come in many forms now. But when I talk about yoga, and virtually when all yoga researchers talk about yoga, they're really talking about the traditional practice of yoga, not just as a physical exercise or a system of exercise, but also as a contemplative practice. So when we talk about yoga, what we're really saying is that this is a practice that incorporates multiple components, multiple techniques that include not only the physical postures, but also the physical exercise, breathing techniques, the deep relaxation techniques, and very importantly, the contemplative side, which is the meditation practice, the practice of mindfulness and focus of attention. And many of us would actually argue that this meditation component of yoga practice is, in fact, perhaps one of the most important components of yoga practice. Now, yoga has become, as I mentioned, very, very popular in the general public, and I think some of the reasons for this is reflected in the reasons for practice, which include not only general wellness and physical exercise, but also, very importantly, many people practice yoga for the purpose of stress management as a stress coping technique. And these yoga practices are very beneficial for both the mind and the body, and there's a lot of research that's demonstrated that. And that has actually given rise to the use of yoga as a therapeutic intervention for a variety of psychological and medical conditions. And so there's not only a popularity of yoga in the general public for wellness, but also for so-called yoga therapy. In fact, if you look at the surveys, there's about 20 million people that are now actively practicing yoga in the general public. And that recent survey conducted by the Yoga Journal also indicated that there was an additional 104 million people who were interested in practicing yoga. In terms of yoga therapy, there was a survey that was done in 2007 by the Center for Disease Control, which showed that 6% of the population was practicing yoga for therapy purposes. And that was up 1% from a survey that was done 5 years before that. So what we're really seeing is that yoga and yoga therapy are not only very popular, but that that popularity is very rapidly growing. And so as we look into the reasons why this is the case, we start to look at what the research has shown us in terms of the benefits of yoga practice, of the psychophysiological changes that take place when you engage in these practices. And these are actually reviewed in a book that was I had just recently published in January. It's published by Harvard Health Publications. It's a Harvard Medical School guide, and the title of the book is Your Brain on Yoga. And in that book, I review a lot of the current evidence that really gives us information on the benefits of what we know about yoga practice and how that helps. So I'm going to summarize these sort of mechanisms that we know from the research that tell us about what yoga does. Well, one of the prime areas of research is that in meditation research. And we know that when you meditate, what that really is the control of attention. And when you control your attention on some kind of target, like the breath or a mantra, you immediately engage these networks in the brain called the attentional networks. And these attentional networks are different than what's going on in the brain when you are ordinarily doing mind wandering, when you're sort of the mode, when your mind is offline, so-called the default mode in your brain. And so that's very different when you control your attention. And as a consequence of that, as you maintain attention, you start to reduce the amount of rumination and mind wandering that goes on. And there's a lot of dysfunctional thinking and a lot of dysfunctional thoughts that occur, actually, in mind wandering. We're usually not thinking about how good we have it. We're usually thinking about problems that we have to face. Now, that actually induces a psychophysiological response that Herbert Benson characterized as the relaxation response. And this is actually a psychophysiological response in the mind and in the body that is the opposite of what we've called the fight or flight response or the stress response. It's actually a rejuvenative response, a restorative response, where now the stress hormones are reduced and the body goes into a recuperative sort of even meditative mode. And that can be very beneficial because over the short term, that will reduce stress response. And over the long term, it will actually lead to what we call resilience, the ability to manage and cope with stress more permanently. And we actually have research that shows that there are structural changes in the brain. Your brain actually changes through plasticity that is known to exist in the brain. So your brain becomes actually more meditative brain, capable of withstanding the stresses of life. And that goes along with a reduction in the emotional reactivity within the brain. There are areas of the brain in the limbic system which are known to be involved in emotional regulation and emotional responses.
And those areas of the brain start to quiet down when you engage in this kind of contemplative practice. The other thing that happens with yoga practice is that there's other things, such as mind-body effects, self-efficacy, self-empowerment, the belief in what you're doing, the expectation of what you're doing, and that engages other networks in the brain that are also beneficial for mental and physical health. Furthermore, as you engage more and more in these meditative practices, there are actually deeper changes that take place in the mind and in the brain. People start to change their relationship to their own lives, their own perception of who they are and where they're going. These are almost self-identity changes. Of course, there's also the changes in physical fitness. Flexibility improves, endurance improves, respiratory function improves. And there may even be direct organ and tissue effects with specific yoga practices. And then, of course, there's also in yoga this idea of subtle energy changes, things like subtle energy like prana that are affecting things like the chakra and the kundalini. And we don't have evidence on these, but these may also be participating. But I think one of the most fundamental, the center of mass, I would say, of the benefits of yoga really are in this ability to reduce stress. And stress is virtually involved in the severity of virtually every mental and physical disorder. And so reduction of stress can play a role in many different diseases by improving your regulation of stress, as well as improving both your mental and physical fitness to bring your body back into balance. And then there's also some evidence that suggests that yoga may be very specific. Specific yoga exercises may have specific benefit for specific disorders. So, for example, if you have a respiratory disorder like emphysema, there are specific breathing techniques that may improve your ability to breathe. So those are sort of real psychophysiological research findings that really support the benefits of yoga practice. I also like to think about yoga practice in the sort of the temporal domain. On the short term, as people practice these techniques, there are changes that occur within a yoga class, but even within 10 to 15 minutes. And this is this arousal reduction, this reduction in the stress response, and also this physical and mental well-being that comes from practicing yoga. And these changes are immediate. This is the satisfaction that people get when they go to a yoga class. They walk in stressed, they walk out much less stressed. However, as people start to practice, things start to change in both the mind, the brain, and the body. And people start to develop a greater mind-body awareness. They develop this resilience to stress, the ability to self-regulate their internal state. And that is very self-empowering and brings the mind and the body back into an equilibrium, a state of ideal balance. But as people practice over the long term, now we're talking, say, months and years, these types of contemplative practices can lead to sort of long-term psychological and philosophical transformation. People start to change their relationship to themselves, their goals, who they are, what they're doing, what their goals are, and they start to gravitate towards more positive behaviors, more positive health behaviors. And that kind of change, in addition to leading to sort of a deeper experience of spirituality and well-being, can also be very valuable for patients with lifestyle diseases who really need to make major changes in their behavior and lifestyle to cope with these lifestyle diseases, which in modern society have actually become epidemic proportions. We're talking about here obesity, diabetes, hypertension, and depression. So in addition to all of this theory that I've just described, we now have a large body of growing evidence of yoga research that's showing that, in fact, in people who already have these types of diseases, yoga can be beneficial. And so we have hundreds of studies now, clinical trials of yoga for specific conditions. Psychiatric conditions like depression and anxiety, cardiovascular conditions like hypertension, heart disease, respiratory conditions like asthma, diabetes, endocrine conditions. There's a huge body of research now showing that yoga is very beneficial for cancer patients. And again, this is not necessarily curing cancer, but certainly dealing with the stress of cancer and the diagnosis of cancer. So these studies are growing. There are now actually reviews of studies of what yoga can do for these variety of conditions. However, many of these studies are still sort of preliminary studies. They're small. And that's what happens as a consequence of any field which is really brand new. Yoga therapy research really didn't start until the 1970s, so we're still a growing field. And however, that field is exploding. We're seeing an exponential rise in the number of clinical trials that are being published in a variety of different clinical conditions like low back pain, depression, and a variety of others. And we're looking at the future in terms of where yoga research is going. There's constantly new disorders that are being evaluated with yoga therapy. We have very powerful neuroimaging techniques that are showing how yoga is affecting the brain. We're even seeing studies that are looking at genomic expression, how yoga practices actually affect our DNA in terms of turning on and turning off specific genes. Ultimately, I think we're going to see that this research will show us specific yoga practice having specific benefits for specific disorders and specific conditions. I think it's important also that we ultimately will be conducting cost-effectiveness studies to show that these studies are really beneficial. They cost little, and yet they are really addressing underlying symptoms and yield long-term benefits. I think an area that's really close to my heart is the prevention aspect of yoga, the maintenance of health, which is really under-recognized in our society. And I think the old adage that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure really works here for yoga. If you can maintain your physical and mental health, you're going to be much more resistant to disease. So that supports our research, and we're trying to bring yoga into public schools and identify, show that yoga in the public schools will provide long-term benefit. And not only that, not only will yoga improve negative conditions, it will enhance positive psychology. It will make people more happy, more functional, and more integrated. Yoga research, I think, is really expanding. I've been involved in organizing, through the International Association of Yoga Therapists, symposia on yoga research. Our next research conference is this coming June in Newton, Massachusetts, where we invite a lot of keynote speakers, and we have a lot of poster sessions. It's a time for researchers to get together, and that will be back-to-back with our symposium on yoga therapy and research, which really integrates many yoga therapists in the field. And I just want to end with a rationale for why we should be doing the research. One would think that just doing the yoga should be enough, and you know, obviously it's very popular, so why do we need to spend the money on research? And the reason is that what we really need is the evidence base to demonstrate that yoga belongs in the medical system as an adjunctive therapy. And the research is necessary for yoga to be justifiably implemented in not only the healthcare system, but we hope also ultimately in the school system. So it's something that's very popular. It's something that's growing very rapidly. And I think that if we can really end up implementing yoga both in our healthcare and school systems, we will see a sea change in the health and well-being of the entire population. So I look for a bright future in the dissemination and the practice of yoga in the general public.
Well, Dr. Khalsa, that was absolutely very, very useful summary, because, and every time you know, you explained how yoga works at the brain level, causing changes in the brain circuitry, and also that these things take effect from few minutes to over months and years. That's a very important summary point, because it, you know, provides the value of the practice in short term as well as medium to long term. Is there like a specific time frame under which these changes happen, and where these changes happen in the brain? Can you elaborate a little bit on that, on what particular areas of the brain get conditioned with the practice in the short term, medium term, and the long term?
Yeah, I think
I think the areas are pretty much similar from the short term over to the long term. I think certainly these changes, studied by Sarah Lazar at Mass General Hospital at Harvard Medical School, has shown that these changes in the brain can take place in as short as 8 weeks. And the areas of the brain that are involved are in those areas of the brain that are in control of attention, self-regulation, self-referential processing. And I think as we go into the longer term, you start to see changes in the emotional brain, the ability to cope with emotion more effectively. And these changes are actually physical changes. They're actually structural changes in the brain. There are areas of the brain that get thicker with practice, and this is evidence of what we call neuroplasticity in the brain. So your brain becomes more effective in coping with this. And some of the areas of the brain that are involved, attentional networks, are in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and that has connections with this area of the brain, the emotional brain, the limbic system. And so you see changes in those two systems that are really important in the regulation of stress and emotional reactivity.
So I would assume, and this is a question actually, I'm jumping a little ahead, by one of our listeners, Christine Stenhagen, who wants to know if there are positive effects on the immune system through the HPA axis by the practice of yoga. So I would assume, as you're explaining, that this might be the case, that this is, it might affect the immune system and other hypothalamus pituitary axis through these circuits.
Yes, this is absolutely true, and we have now some evidence for that. There is a very tight connection between the stress system and the immune system. The HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, is one of the main stress systems. And when you activate this relaxation response through contemplative practices like yoga, you engage this relaxation response, and the hormone that's involved in the HPA axis is cortisol. And the cortisol levels drop down. We now have actual studies that have shown in practical circumstances that bringing these practices to individuals will actually improve immune function. One example of this study done by Richard Davidson in a corporate setting, in a business setting, where they came in, they gave these contemplative practices, meditation and yoga, and then gave the individuals participating an immune challenge. This was a virus. And then they looked at their response to that and showed that those people that had practiced these contemplative practices had a stronger immune response. Another example of in cancer patients, where they've shown that immune factors are greater in people who have practiced yoga than patients who did not have the yoga practice. And this is a whole burgeoning field called psychoneuroimmunology, the relationship between the mind and the brain and the immune system. So I think yoga has a real role to play through stress reduction in enhancing immune function.
Great. So before I bring on the panelists and introduce them, I also wanted to quickly touch base upon what you mentioned, and which is very heartening to hear, that there is more and more clinical trials happening for yoga and meditation, and that we need this evidence for it to become part of medical practice. And so how much have you seen a change in the National Institute of Health or other agencies? Who are the ones who are really funding such research, and how much change has happened in the last decade, and where do you think, in terms of dollars, how much you expect the money to flow in so that we can have more studies like this going forward?
Well, the research really was supported mostly and really accelerated with the formation of the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine at the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. And NCAM was formed to fund alternative and complementary medicine research. And that started in the year 2000. And so since that time, they have accelerated the amount of research that's been done in yoga, because yoga is one of the key areas that they do fund. And I have been funded by in trials that I have conducted, and a lot of my colleagues also. So they have really advanced funding for research in yoga. Now, having said that, you should not be misconstrue the fact that this funding is huge. It's still compared to research like pharmaceutical research and research on surgeries and so on and so forth. It's just a very small drop in the bucket. Research is always being challenged by conventional scientists. So although We have more yoga research going on than ever before compared to conventional research. It is very, very small, and it is very, very difficult to acquire this funding. It's still very, very challenging to maintain a career in yoga research because of the difficulty of getting funding for this work.
Mm-hmm. I will come back to this a little bit, and if we have time, but I will move on now and introduce our panelists one by one. So our first panelist today is Dashama, and she's a yoga and fitness expert with 10-plus years in the industry, training, coaching, and consulting clients and companies in yoga and lifestyle and fitness. She is a multimedia producer with videos, books, and DVDs, which have been featured on Oprah.com, Walmart, Barnes & Noble, Target. And her YouTube channel gets more than 8 million viewers watching her yoga and fitness videos. So with that, I'll bring Dashama on air, and she will have a conversation with you, Dr. Khalsa. Dashama, you are on air.
Hi, yes, thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, we are happy for you to be able to take time out and have a conversation with Dr. Khalsa.
Yes, I just heard everything that you said, Doctor, and it was brilliant. Is there something specifically that you'd like to talk about, or should I interject or ask a question?
Yes, you can ask your questions and from Dr. Khalsa, yes.
Okay, perfect. Absolutely. Yes. You know, I went to college, and in my university, they weren't studying this, so I'm really to see that they are studying these topics at Harvard Medical School. I'd like to talk a little bit about that. It sounds like the type of research that you are doing is exactly what we need, especially in the world today. My background is in fitness, but I definitely have had an extensive time really studying and working in the research aspect of hands-on with people who are overcoming injuries and post-surgery and sickness and anything from mental disorders to physical and emotional imbalances and physical trauma on all levels. And I, too, have seen that yoga and meditation and some other healthy Ayurvedic and lifestyle alterations can really dramatically improve and transform the quality of the human health in many ways. So I'm so happy to see that it's being studied on the medical school level. Are you leading classes in that, or is it just on the research level? That's one of my questions.
Well, I think it's going to be a while before we start to see yoga research and even mind-body medicine research taught in medical schools as part of the main curriculum. I have been teaching an elective course at Harvard Medical School in mind-body medicine over the past 5 or 6 years. But that, of course, is an elective course, and students aren't required to take that. So we have been exposing a few medical students to these to this research evidence and to these practices. But I think in Boston we have a great strength in terms of complementary and alternative medicine research. Herb Benson's Mind-Body Medical Institute has been here for decades working in this area. We have the Osher Center for Clinical for Complementary Medicine here at Harvard Medical School. And we actually have more researchers on yoga in the Boston area than pretty much anywhere else in the country. So it really is kind of a mecca for research on yoga. Having said that, of course, there's only about a half a dozen of us here, and that compares with thousands and thousands of other conventional researchers here in Boston. But it is growing, and we do see yoga research in some of our leading institutions. So the University of California at San Francisco, Duke University, some of the other very strong institutions do have researchers on yoga.
That's fantastic. One question. So where do you primarily get the funding for research? Is it a nonprofit charity organization that you fund through, or is it through grants or a combination?
Well, virtually all research on yoga is funded by grants or private donors. My funding has largely been from the federal government, largely through NCAM. I did have a small grant from the Department of Defense, in fact, to look at yoga for post-traumatic stress disorder. But largely over the past few years, I've been funded actually by private donors through the Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health. They have an Institute for Extraordinary Living directed by Stephen Cope, and they have gone out to private donors to raise funds to conduct our trials on yoga in the public schools. And so for the past 3-4 years, I have been directly funded through the Institute for Extraordinary Living, through private donors. But we get our funding wherever we can, and it is a challenge.
That's fantastic to hear that it's getting the funding, though. Is there anything, what is the future outlook that you see for that branch of the medical center? Would you like to see it integrated as a required course or a whole area or major of study within the Harvard curriculum? Or what's your future outlook for the scholastic side of this study?
Well, I think what we're doing with yoga research is we're building what's called an evidence base. We're building up a critical mass of clinical trial evidence that shows the benefits of yoga in healthy individuals and in different disease states. Once that critical mass reaches a certain point, there is justification to then start including that in the medical curriculum. So at that point, medical students will be taught that these techniques are available. Once you get it at that level, at that scholastic level, to the medical practitioners, that's when it starts to get disseminated into society. So just to give you an example, a farmer in Alabama has insomnia. He goes to his doctor 5 years ago and says, "I have insomnia." He gets a sleeping pill right away. So in the future, at some point in time, when yoga research is taught in medical schools and medical schools students are made aware of that technique being available, that future scenario would see that farmer going to his doctor, and the doctor would say, "You know, I could give you a sleeping pill, but there's now some research evidence showing that yoga is good for insomnia, so why don't you try that first? And if that doesn't work, then we can always come back to the pill, but let's go with that first." And that is a sea change. That's where the thing really starts to change.
Yeah, I agree 100%. One thing that I would love to talk with you about further is I've been developing a television show about the effect of yoga and meditation on the human health experience, and we're actually going to be filming this. And we've been looking to actually integrate a doctor into the show. It's kind of a mix between Eat, Pray, Love meets the Biggest Loser concept, where we actually take somebody with some sort of a condition, whether it's a surgery that they've overcome and now they're healing, or a post-traumatic syndrome or some eating disorder, the types of relatable conditions that society and humanity is facing at this time, and then applying the techniques of yoga and holistic health and specific dietary changes and meditation and all of this practices, and then through a 30-day program, watching their transformations and the healing process, and at the end, seeing the results. So it's kind of a study, a little bit of a research study, but more in the media realm, and we're going to be doing a documentary, so perhaps we can talk a little bit more about that. But we'd love to actually support you in any way that we can as a fundraiser for your research, because I feel that it's very important what you're doing.
Yes, and of course, any kind of private donors who are affluent, who can see the value of yoga research, we're happy to take funds to support this work. Really, funding is the only limitation we face in moving yoga research forward. There is no resistance from the institutions. There's no resistance from the existing faculty at our schools. There's no dearth of people who are interested in conducting yoga research. The only limitation we face is funding. So wherever that funding comes, whether it's from private donors or from federal agencies, we'll take it, and we have the people that that are interested in doing and conducting the research.
Well, thank you, Dashama, for your questions. I'll bring on the next panelist, Dr. Khalsa, but just as a ballpark figure, what do you think in terms of dollar amount would be needed to bring yoga research to the forefront, you know, the kind of vision you have in your mind? What would be, just curious to know what kind of dollar amount is that, just a ballpark number. It would be interesting for our listeners to know that.
Well, I can't really speak on sort of global terms because I don't work at that level. I work on the level of an individual clinical trial. So, for example, the major grant that NIH funds, which funds a full-size clinical trial, 5 years long, that grant is worth $1.25 million. So that's what it takes to run single full clinical trial. So as you can imagine, if you want to run hundreds of these trials, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. That is partly now supported to some degree by NCAM on a very limited budget. Of course, NCAM funds not only yoga, but also other alternative medicines, such as acupuncture. The amount of research that's funded by NCAM is small, but it's something that was never there before.
That's interesting. Well, I mean, the personal mission as a technology entrepreneur, there are a group of us who always question why there hasn't been a foundation that has been, has donated towards yoga and meditation. We hope to be among those foundations that are able to generate this kind of funds needed to promote yoga. But that'll happen in due course. Now, bring our next panelist on air, and she's Char Grossman. Char is professionally recognized as a therapeutics yoga specialist, special education intervention teacher, and a nationally certified yoga psychologist. She's an experienced registered yoga teacher as well, and she has obtained professional training at Duke Integrative Medicine in Yoga Awareness for Cancer and completed MD Anderson Integrative Medicine Program's Oncology Training Conference. And she's also set up Yoga Reach as a therapeutic yoga program that inspires individuals of all ages and abilities to develop educational, physical, mental, and social competencies. So, Char, you're on air, and go ahead. Yes.
Hello, Dr. Kalfa. I think we met many years ago through the IAYT. I'm very active in that also, and I've enjoyed reading all the different types of research projects that you have done. Years and years ago, I suffered an acute intracranial hemorrhage, and I underwent the resection of the cavernous vascular malformation. And the surgery was done at the Cleveland Clinic, and they went ahead and removed the anomaly. But what it left me with was the right hemiparesis, aphasia, cognitive deficits, right upper quadrant visualization fields, and lots of emotional problems with stress. And, you go through the different types of treatments and therapies like the OT, the PT, et cetera, and speech therapy, and, that's supposed to cure you, and it didn't. And I got very upset and aggravated, and my stress level was, like, so high that the word yoga came up on my computer, and I ended up going to Omega at that point, and Beryl Bender Birch put me through a yoga class that she was teaching and said, if you put your mind and body together, you can make changes. And I had never heard of this. This was like, 19 years ago. Who heard of that? And the thing that research has been showing with the neuroplasticity is that it can make changes. I have a full 100%, 150% recovery. And it's really due to the yoga. And, yes, there's other things involved also. But, yoga is my life. And my question to you would be, as a young stroke survivor, in the past, I haven't seen much research as far as being done with the people that are young stroke survivors. I've seen lots of different types of research with veterans, with people that are between 70 and, much older than that. But I haven't seen any types of studies with people that are between, say, 20-some and, 50-ish. Like, I was right in the middle there. And I would love to know how you implement a research study that would be able to show that young stroke survivors can be, can have some of the deficits change, can have some of their healing, really happen due to going through a yoga program, say 6 to 8 weeks. And I'm not a research person anymore. I mean, I was when I was in the public schools. But now, I would teach the class, being the yoga therapist, but I would like to hook up with somebody that would be able to take yoga and look at how it's going to implement and how it's going to improve people that are young stroke survivors. Is there any specific way that I would go about finding out about that?
Well, what you're talking about is really research design. And actually, yoga is not that much different than another intervention. And so the research design that you would use would be a randomized controlled trial.
Okay.
And of course, that involves all of the things that are well known in research design. You have to have a control group with the matching characteristics in order to really have some sense of confidence. You have to screen the population. You have to make as homogeneous a population as possible, depending upon what you're trying to address. So this is all something that is well learned by people who are scientists in training, is to how to develop a strong research design in order to address these questions. And there's a lot of specifics involved, the type of population, the type of intervention, the standardization of the intervention, the kinds of outcome measures, what you measure in terms of benefit, how you analyze the data, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of complexity involved, and that's why it takes people who have spent years and years training in scientific research to design these studies. So depending upon the scientific question you're asking, there would be a different research design. You could be looking at short-term effects. You could be looking at long-term effects. You could be looking at physical, psychomotor. You could be looking at motor function.
Right.
You could be psychological function. All of these things are different, will change the research design to look at different things. Now,
in the field of stroke, there's not really been that much that's been published at this point in time in yoga. In fact, of the 25 or so papers that cite anything to do with yoga and stroke, almost half of them have been published in the past 3 years or so.
Right.
And all of trials that have been published are very, very small preliminary trials. So there's a lot of opening here to evaluate the benefits of yoga for stroke victims. But alluding to what you were saying earlier, this whole mind-body, invoking the mind-body connection, it's almost a miracle. It's amazing how powerful this stuff is, and it's just so simple that it seems like there's got to be some kind of trick somewhere, but there really isn't. It's just as simple as that. What you're doing is integrating the mind and the body through this contemplative practice, and that comes up with these miraculous findings. I mean, there are constantly new disorders yoga is being applied for that are stunning me. I mean, had you asked me 10 years ago if yoga was good for schizophrenia, I would have been very doubtful, but
right.
Now there's a whole body of literature on that.
Exactly.
Showing benefits of yoga for schizophrenia. So it really is amazing how something so simple can have such profound effects.
Well, that's what's very interesting to me. And I do work with some stroke patients, and I also work with people with Parkinson's. And specifically with the stroke patient and the caregiver is watching the stroke patient be able to open up the right hand, which has been, gone through right hemiparesis, and they have it like a fist, and I say, no, the fingers can open between the mind and the body. We can do that. And, the caregiver is just, so amazed that the person can open their whole hand. And I'm not, a miracle worker, but I know that it works. And if I can do it, I would think that many other people can do it. So that's what I would like to, be teaching others, how to get different types of people with medical challenges, how to make them really improve in their health as much as, they are able to. I do have one more question, which basically goes with the Kripala yoga in the schools program. When you look at high school students, they have so many stressors, be it, waking up super early in the morning to get to school and studying late at night, and maybe they're trying out for, one of the teams and they're not sure they're going to make it, et cetera. And, stress just keeps coming to high school kids all the time. And I wondered, with the Kripala program, has there been a lot of research that's showing how the yoga is helping those high school students decrease the stress that may be affecting them during the day?
Well, obviously, this is the center of the research in my laboratory. Now, we've only been conducting this research for about 3 to 4 years. But what we have shown in both quantitative and qualitative studies is that, indeed, these students are developing the ability to self-regulate, the ability to cope with stress more effectively. they're describing that they are actually using these practices in day-to-day life. They're starting to become less anxious. They're starting to become more calm and more focused. And that has consequences on all kinds of behaviors, on risk factors for substance abuse, on risk factors for overeating, for insomnia, for a whole variety of things. I mean, our adolescent and child population is under enormous stress, and it's just under-recognized. And the problem is that our school system has nothing in place to teach our kids to cope with this stress. It's really not there. Our school system is focused on academic achievement, not on emotion regulation. And so our goal in showing this research is that emotion regulation is extremely important for the mental and physical health of our kids, as well as for their academic performance, because the two are tied together. And so to us, this is a very important field of research, but it's really in its infancy. There are less than 24 studies, and these are all very small studies on yoga in school settings. So it's really a field that deserves a lot of research.
Thank you, Char. In the interest of time, because we're running short on time now, I will bring on our last panelist, Micheline. And we have a couple of questions from the audience as well, so I would like to squeeze them in. So let me quickly introduce Micheline. She is an oncology counselor at Life with Cancer. And in addition to being a licensed clinical social worker, she's a registered yoga teacher and certified end-of-life counselor. She helped develop a 6-week mind-body education series, leads yoga and meditation classes of patients and caregivers, and facilitates support group. Micheline, you're on air, and please go ahead.
Hi, is Dave there?
Yes.
Hello? Oh, okay, great.
Yes,
hi.
You're on air,
This has been wonderful, and I actually have a larger scale question than one of the ones I submitted. I hope that's okay as I'm listening. My mind is going in different directions. I work within a large medical system, the Inova Healthcare System in Northern Virginia, which, you know, is not synonymous with contemplative practice. And I'm just sort of wondering, are there large medical systems around the country that have integrated yoga and or contemplative practices into their medical care, and what that might look like if people were sort of prescribing this? Are you familiar with any that have already done this?
Well, this is an area that we're striving to get into. There are not a lot of examples where this has been implemented. There are certain fields in which it's more implemented. It's difficult to find a cancer center now that doesn't offer yoga.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the lobbying effort. It's one thing to have the research in hand. It's another thing to actually promote this research and move it into the reimbursement and medical care system. One of the leading lights in this area is actually Dean Ornish, who's conducted yoga lifestyle interventions in cardiac disease and in prostate cancer, for example. And he's working at this level of moving these kinds of integrative mind-body practices into medicine. He was actually involved in the recent change in Medicare support for a yoga program, a yoga lifestyle program for heart disease. So that's an example of where this can go.
Awesome. If we, at our cancer center, we see thousands of patients a year. If we were wanting to sort of offer those patients into, funnel them into some larger research efforts, what would you suggest might be our next step?
Well, what you really need is a researcher, a principal investigator at the site who is interested and motivated in this work, and then what you need is funding for that investigator.
Okay.
That investigator can write a grant. It's very difficult to run a study without funds. A lot of investigators do need to run small pilot trials with volunteer effort to try and get pilot data. Pilot data is then used to justify applications for a larger grant. So what you really need is a principal investigator really dedicated to this, to get dedicated to yoga research. And the problem with yoga research is it's difficult to get funding. Going into yoga research has been described as career suicide from the convention.
Yeah.
Because it's really a challenge. However, some of us are meeting with success. Perhaps one of the leading lights in this field is Lorenzo Cohen at MD Anderson, who has gotten funding for a phase 3, a very large trial of yoga for cancer patients in the millions and millions of dollars. And so there's an example of someone who has had success in making a major trial of yoga.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. We do have one more panelist who was supposed to dial in, but we can't see her online. Krishna, if you're there, can you just press 1 on your phone and we'll know you're on the call, and then we'll try to get you on air. But we have Mikhail D. Temple who wants to ask a question, and I'll bring her on air. Mikhail? Would you like to ask your question? Number 720-371-6410. You're on air. Okay, I'll read out her question. She wants to know, what are a couple of yoga breath techniques that might be helpful for relaxation, Dr. Carlson?
Well, I think that's a general yoga question.
I think
the most powerful and the most central breathing technique in yoga is the long, slow, deep breathing pattern. And when you combine that long, slow, deep breathing with a meditation component, for example, meditating on the breath or meditating on a phrase or a word, you end up with having a very, very powerful technique that is not only very effective at reducing stress and making changes in the autonomic nervous system, but also one that's virtually easy to use no matter what your condition. That is an extremely powerful technique, and so I would rate that as number one, the long, slow, deep breathing pattern, breathing at about, if possible for the individual, down to 4 breaths per minute, and it's important that this breathing pattern be done appropriately so that the movement of the abdomen is involved, so-called abdominal or belly breathing, moving with the entire torso, the full yogic breath, and I think that is the most fundamental breathing practice that has enormous benefits. There are a number of other breathing techniques that may be used depending upon the disorder, but we don't have a lot of scientific research. But a yoga therapist may have sort of personal experience with the particular benefits of these types of breathing practices. I'm talking about things like alternate nostril breathing or a fast breathing technique called Kapalabhati. So most of what we know and what we really put our money into is the long, slow breathing process.
Okay, so I'll ask one few other questions because we have 5-6 minutes left on the call. There were a bunch of questions submitted by multiple myeloma patients, and their main worry or concern is that is yoga possible for multiple myeloma patients? Is it safe because some of these patients have bony lesions, especially in the spine and ribs? And Dr. Khalsa, if you have had any experience working in this area, or any Kachar or Michelle, if you would like to jump in, Dashama, if you've worked with any multiple myeloma patients, please chime in after Dr. Khalsa about your opinion about such patients and what precautions they should take if they want to do yoga.
I think I will leave the specifics to the yoga therapist and the clinician, because I'm not a clinician or a yoga therapist myself, but I will make a general comment. But yoga for the general public is not the same as yoga therapy. Yoga therapy tailors the yoga interventions to accommodate the individuals and the limitations that those individuals have in those particular disorders. But I can say pretty definitively that you can always do something. Even if it's long, slow, deep breathing with meditation on the breath, that is extremely hard. You can add even minor postures or physical practices to that, that's fine. But the specifics are really important. So it's very important to have that information conveyed to a yoga instructor at the individual home, or for the yoga therapist to be very familiar with the characteristics of the disorder.
So, Micheline and Char, have you ever worked with any multiple myeloma patients, and have you got any advice for them?
This is Micheline, and I have worked with several multiple myeloma patients one-on-one, and I would echo what Dr. Falco is saying. I tend to focus on the sort of breathing practices, the relaxation. I think just a regular off-the-street yoga class can be really contraindicated. There are a lot of things they probably shouldn't be doing. The meditative work, and also even with the asana practice, the physical components of it, having that can be very restorative. So that, you know, bolstering them, propping them up, and really keying in specifically to limitations and pain places that they might have.
Char and Dashama, if you have anything to add before we move on to the next question.
This is Char.
Yes, Char.
You know, my concern is, you know, the way their body is and as far as their brittleness. And I agree with the statements that were made already with the meditation, but I would do like even a visualization. You know, get them dreaming about something, get them looking about something, teach them how to make energy go into those body parts where they are definitely in pain. You know, everything else, it depends on the individual, obviously, but, you know, I don't feel comfortable saying they should do this, this, or that. But something, you know, with a visualization or just related to meditation and the restorative seems to make the most sense.
Absolutely, and I would just add that my perspective is always to include lifestyle changes. So in addition to breath work and visualization and various yoga therapy practices, I would always suggest a change in diet and a movement towards alkalinizing the diet with green juices and a lot of water that's alkaline to balance the pH, as well as integrating music therapy and chanting, which can really help balance the temperatures of the brain, but also the frequency that the body is carrying. Because when it's in a state of sickness like that, it needs something to bring the cells into a state of harmony. And so music can be very powerful for that, both to listen to and also to sing and chant along with it. And so I recommend that to my patients as well.
Sure. Thank you, folks. Actually, this was asked by Pamela Shields, and I think she's on the call, though we couldn't get her on air. So I hope that answers Pamela's request for specific information about myeloma patients. We have 4 minutes left for the call to end, so I will take up one last question, and we can go through with Dr. Carlson and then the panelists, and that is, you know, general questions people have asked, how can yoga help someone with cancer? And if yes, are there any contraindications about what to do or what not to do? So, Dr. Khalsa, very quickly, if you can summarize anything for cancer patients and words of advice for them, followed by Char, Micheline, and Dashama.
Yeah, I think the center of mass of yoga is really appropriate for cancer patients, and that is stress reduction. That's really the goal that yoga practice is for in cancer patients. So it's not really to cure cancer, although that's not inconceivable in individual cases, depending upon the individual. But I think the goal is really stress reduction. And the other thing about yoga therapy is that it has to be very individualized to be most effective. It's not a one-size-fits-all. There's different types of cancer, there's different patients, different fragility, different stages in the cancer process, with the diagnosis, with the chemotherapy, the surgery, the post-surgery. And every individual is very different. So I think individualization is very important, bearing in mind that person's limitations and capabilities.
Char and Micheline, do you have anything to add there?
Yeah, I was going to just mention that with individualization, which I totally agree about, that as yoga therapists, as yoga teachers, if we do have people that are walking in with cancer or any other medical challenge, we have to know how to individualize, whether we have, you know, five people in the group or it's a one-on-one situation, because everybody, you know, is obviously different. And the more that we can do for that person to feel, you know, life and to get themselves, you know, in a state of mind, be it through the music, like Dashna said, you know, that's what they really need.
Sure. Well, I think we're running out of time, so we'll have to cut this out here now. But just to summarize, Dr. Khalsa, thank you for your wonderful summary on how yoga actually causes changes in the neural structures and circuits, and that these changes happen from very quick 10-15 minute to as long as months and years. And that is very encouraging to know that there's more and more research being supported by the NIH and the federal agencies on yoga, and clinical trials are exploding, though it's still a ways before we can have more trials and more knowledge to make yoga a prescribed therapy in the medical practice. Thank you, all the panelists, for taking your time out and for your thoughtful comments and insights. Thank you to all the listeners and for all the questions that came in. We will be having the series on an ongoing basis, and we hope to have the next one in June and send out information about this to everyone. I hope everybody enjoyed the show, and we would really welcome your feedback, as this is the first time we had something on yoga, and we really want to support alternative and complementary medicine through this talk show. Dr. Khalsa, once again, thank you very much, and we look forward to more such conversations in the future.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everybody. And the recording for this will be available online on our blog, Cure Talk. And Priya will also send it out to everybody via email. Thank you once again, and have a lovely day.
Thank you.